Turn in your Bibles to Luke 22. We're going to start in verse 39. And I am going to attempt to cover the Garden of Gethsemane, the arrest of Jesus, the Jewish trials, and the Roman trials. So with that, we're going to be also somewhat harmonizing the Gospels. And so I've tried to put them in what I think is the correct order, the chronological order. So we're going to be bouncing around a lot here this morning, so definitely have to keep your Bibles handy there. But Luke 22, verse 39, it says, coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives. So coming out of where? Yeah, the upper room. So this is after, as we've talked about, John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. This is kind of summarizing all of that, really leaving the upper room, going to the Mount of Olives. So after John 17, after Christ finished his high priestly prayer, he now goes into what we know as the Garden of Gethsemane. So he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. What is the cup that Christ is referring to there? Yeah, the suffering and death of the cross. Really, that reason for which he came into the world. If you go back in your minds to John chapter 12, where Christ talks about it, he says, should I pray that I be delivered from this hour? He says, no, because it's for this hour that I came into the world. And so Christ now is in the Garden of Gethsemane praying that if it be the will of the Father, that this be taken from him. But again, most importantly, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. We have talked about this before, so I'm just going to mention that we struggle with these prayers in Gethsemane because, you know, we read it and we have almost the sense that Jesus really is resisting the will of the Father. And there's been a lot of explanations for why Jesus prayed this, and probably one of the more common ones is that, well, it was Jesus' flesh was rebelling against the agony that he knew was going to come. In his humanity, he was feeling the resistance. And I don't think that's accurate, because it somehow puts the humanity of Christ at odds with the deity of Jesus, and we can't do that. As I've said in the past, what I think Christ is really looking at when he says, let this cup pass from me, is ultimately the separation from the Father that was going to come in the crucifixion. And we remember Christ crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Christ is desirous to not be separated from the Father. And that's a legitimate desire. That's not a sinful desire. To desire unbroken fellowship with the Father is righteous. And so that Christ in his perfect humanity and his perfect deity is desiring this unbroken fellowship, but also recognizing that there's a greater will here. There's a greater purpose. And I would say as well, we cannot read this as saying that somehow in eternity past that Jesus was opposed to this plan and that Jesus just went reluctantly to come to the earth and then to die on the cross. We have to recognize that even during his life, but especially in eternity past, that this was the full agreement of all three members of the Trinity that this is the way that men would be saved. And so we can't imagine some resistance to the plan of God because this was Christ's plan. Rather, we have a desire here, a righteous desire to continue in unbroken fellowship with the Father, but also the righteous desire to bring salvation to men. So does that make sense at all? I know I've taken 2 minutes to explain something. I think last time I took about 20 minutes to go through. So any quick questions on that? Let's keep reading then. It says, verse 43, then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. And Luke is the only one who mentions the angel, just as an aside there. But an angel appeared from heaven, strengthening him, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And Luke's the only one that mentions that particular detail as well, but it's a hugely significant detail because medically we have found that this is physically possible. So it's not some supernatural thing that's happening there, but rather it is the stress is so great that the capillaries in the scalp burst. And so that in the stress, as he is sweating, the blood from the burst capillaries is mixing with the sweat. And so that it looks like, as Luke says here, it became as. It looked like great drops of blood. And I mention that not just for the fact that it gives us an indication of the stress Christ was under, the physical duress, long before he actually began to be tortured by the Jews and the Romans. There's a deep stress, a distress right here. But there's also in this, there's these indications of eyewitness testimony. These facts here, that there was an angel that ministered to him, and that Christ's blood became as great drops of blood, that's something that the only ones who are going to know are the ones who are there. And we don't know, and Luke doesn't tell us his source here. So we don't know who told Luke these things. I think we recognize Luke wasn't there. Luke, if he was alive at the time, which he probably was, he was over, I think, in Philippi, in Greece, a long ways away from Jerusalem. It wasn't until years later that Luke is saved and begins to investigate and do this research that results in the book of Luke. But he has some eyewitness testimony that tells him, and say he knows these things there. And in all the Gospels, there are these marks of this eyewitness testimony that show its reliability. Verse 45, when he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. Then he said to them, "Why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation." And while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. Now, you may notice that Luke only, in talking about the prayers, he only talks about Christ going and praying and then coming to the disciples and saying, "Why do you sleep?" Matthew and Mark tell us that this happened three times. Christ went and prayed, came back, they were sleeping, woke them up, told them to watch and pray, went back, prayed. So again, and the third time is when Judas came to him and he kissed him. And Jesus said to him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" And so go to John 18, verse 4. Why did Judas kiss Jesus? I'm not going to read it, but I trust you remember. Yeah, exactly. That was the sign Judas had given to the soldiers from the priest, saying, "This is the one you want to arrest." Judas told them, "I'm going to kiss the man you arrest." And so he greets him with this kiss. So verse 4, John chapter 18. And I think this happens after Judas kisses him. So there's some question here about the exact order here, but I think this happens. So Judas comes up, greets Jesus, kisses him on the cheek. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, "Whom are you seeking?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with them. Now when he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, in your Bibles, look closely at the phrase, "I am he." Do you notice anything different about the font in that phrase? He is italicized. What does that mean? Exactly. It's not in the original Greek, but rather it is added to make the sentence make sense to English ears. So what Jesus actually says is, "I am." And I'm going to give you a little bit of more Greek here. It's ego ami. And it's a huge phrase in the Gospel of John. Over and over again, Jesus says, "Ego ami," the bread of life, the water of life, the good shepherd. But Jesus also says, before Abraham was, "Ego ami," I am. And so there is a very definite, I think in the Gospel of John, there's this intentionality of using this phrase. John's the only one who tells us this particular part of the arrest. But when Jesus says to them, "I am," what happens? Well, I think they fall over backwards myself. But yeah, they topple in some way. And just this simple declaration that seems to be, and their response to it indicates that it is much more than just a declaration, "Yes, I'm Jesus, I'm the one that you're looking for." There is in that the declaration and the power of deity. And so verse 7, after they pick themselves back up, he says to them again, "Whom are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Jesus of Nazareth." And there's things in this story that make me wonder. So you're there with a troop of soldiers, armed and armored and all of that, going to arrest this guy. And he says, "Who are you looking for?" You tell him, or your leader, sergeant, or whatever he is there in charge of the group, tells him who. He says, "I am," and everybody's knocked over. When you get back up, what are you thinking at that point in time? Yeah, now the guy in charge is thinking, "Okay, I have a duty to do, I'm sure. I have to arrest this guy. I don't know who he is. I don't know what he is. I don't want to do this, but I have to do it. It's my job." And I'm sure everybody there is thinking, "We don't want to be here. We don't want anything to do with this." And yet they continue through with it. Again, I would tend to say simply doing their duty. Verse 8, Jesus answered, I have told you that I am he. Therefore, if you seek me, let these go their way, that the saying might be fulfilled which he spoke, of those whom you gave me, I have lost none. She said that in the upper room discourse. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. And here's another detail. John's the only one who gives us this particular detail, but he tells us the name of the servant. The servant's name was Malchus. So there's, again, more evidences of eyewitness testimony. And later John is going to say, he's not going to refer to himself by name, but John is going to say later in this record of the trials of Jesus that John knew the members of the high priest household, that he was known to them, that there was an interaction and sufficient familiarity that when Jesus was arrested, John went into the high priest courtyard and asked them to let Peter in too. And so that there was enough familiarity there that he could ask for, if you will, a little bit of a special favor for that. So John is certainly in a position to know by name the servants of the high priest. I'm sure he didn't know all of them, but he very evidently knew this one, Malchus. And Jesus said to Peter, put your sword into the sheath. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me? So we have now the answer to Jesus' prayer. If it be possible, let this cup be taken away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but your will be done. Now Jesus says, this is the cup I will drink. I will do the will of the Father. And it says, then the detachment of troops and the captains and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Go back to Luke 22, verse 51. And verse 49, again, tells of Peter striking the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. Jesus saying, permit even this. In verse 51 of Luke 22, and he touched his ear and healed him. So that Malchus did not go through life with just one ear. Rather, Christ healed him. And again, I'm wondering, how did this guy respond? I mean, Jesus walks up and heals him. And what does this servant do? I don't think he's in a position, as far as authority goes, to do anything to stop what's happening. But how do you respond? And then you've got the soldiers there standing around. They watch Jesus walk up and heal this man's ear. I don't know if it grew back or if he picked it up off of the ground and stuck it on his head or whatever. But they see it healed, and yet they continue to arrest Jesus. Verse 52, Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, and elders who had come to him. So it wasn't just the soldiers there. There was seemed to be a pretty good crowd who had come to make sure this arrest went off, which explains some more of the reason why the soldiers continued trying to arrest Jesus and continued with the arrest of Jesus, because their bosses were right there watching them. And he says to them, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. So go to Mark 14, verse 15. Now, why did they arrest Jesus in the middle of the night in the Garden of Gethsemane instead of in the temple? Exactly. Scriptures tell us in several places they were afraid of the people. And so they did this secretly. Mark 14, verse 50, who's the all? All his disciples flee, leaving him exactly as Jesus had warned them and said would happen. And then verse 51, Mark includes a detail that's, again, in no other passage. It says, now a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body. And the young men, that would be probably servants and others there with the hangers on, laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. So we don't know exactly how this young man ended up in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's possible he was awake in the night and saw this troop of soldiers marching out, and so he's curious, he followed them. It could be that, because he certainly is associated with the disciples, it could be that he actually was maybe following them. He knew of the meeting in the upper room, and he saw them leave, and he's following them to the Garden of Gethsemane. But somehow he ends up there, and he tells us this little bit. Again, it indicates eyewitness testimony, and the common assumption is that this is Mark himself, the author of the Gospel of Mark. It doesn't state that. It's not something that can be proven by any means, but it is a pretty typical assumption, is that this is Mark saying, basically, I was there and I fled too. He ran and betrayed Christ as well. So back to John chapter 18, verse 13. So they arrest Jesus, they bind him, and then they lead him away. And now begins the trials, the public legal, and I use that word loosely because all the Jewish trials were illegal, but the public legal trials in there. Does anybody know how many legal trials Jesus faced in that night? Okay, illegal trials. How about that? Yeah, six. There was three Jewish trials, and then there were three Roman trials. And so we're seeing now the first of the Jewish trials in verse 13. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now, this is an important little detail that really becomes significant in understanding both how Jerusalem worked and the leadership of Jerusalem worked at that time. Caiaphas was the high priest of Israel, according to Roman rule. But according to Jewish thinking, Annas was the high priest of Israel. Because the high priest was appointed, and it was more or less for life. Certainly the priest served from 30 years old to 50 years old. And there's indications that the high priest just served until their death. We actually saw that with Aaron in the book of Numbers. He serves as high priest until his death. And so Annas was the high priest of Israel, but he annoyed the Romans, and so they deposed him and appointed someone else in the same family to be high priest, and then someone else. And so Caiaphas is, I think, the third or fourth high priest after Annas was deposed by the Romans. And so Annas has an incredible amount of power, and there's a very real possibility that he is the power behind the high priest, that he is actually the still functional high priest in everything but name only. So they take Jesus to Annas because he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, and it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And we see that back in John 11 in response to the resurrection of Lazarus. The Jews celebrated Christ, as you can well imagine. This happens in Bethany, near to Jerusalem. So this is right in the high priest bailiwick there. This is in their neighborhood. They're seeing this. They can't avoid this. And Lazarus is raised from the dead. The people are celebrating Christ, and there's nothing they can do about it. The high priests are powerless. And so their great plan is, first, let's kill Lazarus, and then let's kill Jesus. Because their thought was, well, Jesus is going to stir up a revolt. The people, at least, are going to revolt against Rome and follow Jesus, and that's going to just cause all kinds of problems, which they were right there. If the Jewish people had revolted, Rome would have come down on them very, very hard, as it did about 40 years later when Jerusalem and the temple were finally and fully destroyed. But Caiaphas's plan was kill Jesus. And he says to them, it is necessary and it is better for one man to die for the people. If I had time, we'd really go look at it. But John makes the point here as stressing that because Caiaphas was the high priest, he speaks prophetically. I don't think Caiaphas recognized what he was doing. But God, working through Caiaphas, even though Caiaphas is a rebellious and wicked high priest, God's still speaking through him. And so that Caiaphas speaks prophetically of the death of Jesus. And so Caiaphas is an important figure, and we're certainly going to see it here as we keep going through these trials. But the first trial is before Annas. And this is completely illegal in many respects. According to Rome, Annas had no power. And this is a trial taking place in his house, not in any kind of official location and any kind of a public location. And it seems as if it is during the first hearing before Annas that Peter first denies Christ. Peter is out in the courtyard of the high priest's house. I'm thinking it's a high priestly complex. You know, it's not just a house and there's one family there. We know there were servants and others there. So it's very likely that they take Jesus first to Annas's apartment. He would have probably his own space in that complex, and he'd take him first to Annas. Peter is out in the courtyard while Jesus is being interviewed by Annas, that Peter first denies Christ. And then Jesus is taken from there to Caiaphas. And then Matthew and Mark really tell us about that trial. So go to Mark chapter 14, verse 53. It says, "And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. But Peter followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. Now the chief priest and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then it says, and some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But not even then did their testimony agree. So, again, there's major problems here with this proceeding. Does anybody remember from the Old Testament laws, in a capital case, so when the death penalty is on the table, how many witnesses must there be before someone can be sentenced to death? It's two or three, at least two witnesses that are giving the same testimony, that are in agreement together. And how many did they find that agreed? None. Yeah, so they did manage to dig up two people. So it sounds like they brought a parade of witnesses, but all of them were telling different stories. None of their testimonies agreed. They finally brought up two people who talked about this destroying the temple thing. But even there, even though they talked about the same event, their testimonies still were not in agreement. And so without two or three witnesses in agreement together, they have no legal grounds to execute Jesus. So the trial before Annas, or the hearing before Annas, is illegal. They've now taken him to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, and I think they have suborned perjury. They have gone out and sought false witnesses against Jesus. But certainly, they have taken these witnesses and they do not agree sufficiently to give a legal verdict of guilty, but they accept them anyway. And I didn't mention it, but there's certainly, it's illegal for them to have a middle of the night hearing as well. It has to be during the daytime, has to be in a public place. This seems to be still taking place somewhere in the high priestly household, and it's in the middle of the night. And so go on, verse 16. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But he kept silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him, saying to him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Now, this is a huge problem, again, legally, because the Jewish courts had something similar to our Fifth Amendment. In America, you cannot be forced to testify against yourself. And in their court system, they could not condemn someone based on his own testimony. So actually, it was illegal for them to take a witness and put him in an interrogation room and just interrogate him until he confessed. They could not convict somebody based on his own testimony. So the priest asking him, answer them, is completely out of line. This is not the way their courts worked. And then turning around to Christ and demanding an answer of him about this charge is, again, completely illegal. And Jesus answers and says, I am. And then he goes on, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds in heaven. So put a bookmark here because we're going to come back. But go to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. This is one of Daniel's visions. It's things in this case is speaking of the future yet to come when the Son of God descends to the earth in victory. And Daniel says in Daniel 7, verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. Who's the Ancient of Days? Yeah, God the Father. And so we have the Son of Man, God the Son, coming to God the Father, and they brought him near before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So when Jesus says, I am the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed, and you will see him at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven, he's hearkening back to Daniel chapter 7. And so he is telling them, not only, yes, am I the Messiah, yes, I am the Son of God, yes, I am the coming King who will establish an eternal kingdom. He gives them more than they ask for and tells them, I am God. I am the promised Messiah. I am the coming ruler. And so go back to Mark chapter 14 again, verse 62. Jesus says, I am. You'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power, coming with the clouds of heaven. Verse 63. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? Then they all condemned him to be deserving of death. So their condemnation is, make it clear, is not based on the false witness testimonies. The whole destroy the temple and raise it up again, at least in the language of Scripture, there's no connection between that and this blasphemy of which they accused Jesus of. But again, it's absolutely illegal because they are condemning Jesus based on his own testimony, which you cannot do, and based on his testimony alone, which even in the case of confessed guilt, there had to be two or three witnesses. So you couldn't just come up and confess and that be the end of it. There still had to be other witnesses to pronounce someone guilty. Verse 65, then some began to spit on him and to blindfold him and to beat him and to say to him, prophesy. And the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. So, you know, he's surrounded by the nobility, the leaders of Israel. They illegally pronounce him guilty. And then some in that crowd, it doesn't tell us if it's members of the Sanhedrin or just their servants or just the soldiers that would have been present, it may have been all of the above, begin to abuse him. And to put it in American images, you're in the courtroom. The judge is up there. He's just pronounced guilty. The prosecuting attorney here, the defense attorney is here, the defendant is there. And the judge says guilty, and everybody in the room jumps up and begins to attack the guilty person. Or the one pronounced guilty. Is that legal in America? No. Do you think it was legal in Israel? No, it was not legal at all. They, again, had very strict protections for prisoners and for those on trial. It could not be abused and assaulted like this. And so they are showing just an utter disregard for their own legal system. And it is during this time, this trial before Caiaphas, that we see the second and third denials from Peter. And I know you're familiar with them. I'm just going to skim through them down to verse 72 of Mark 14. And it says, a second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And when he thought about it, he wept. So there we have the fulfillment of Jesus' words again in the upper room, telling not only the disciples, you'll abandon me, but telling Peter specifically, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter at this point remembers Jesus' words and he weeps. And then verse 1 of Mark chapter 15. Immediately in the morning, the chief priest held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and led him away. So this is part of how we know everything before this happened in the night. Because as soon as it was morning, as soon as it was daylight, the sun began to rise, they have a third trial. And this is just a formality at this point. All this is doing is giving a veneer of legality to everything that they've done. Because again, having a middle of the night trial was illegal. And so for them to now have someone executed, they have to have at least an appearance of legality. And so as soon as it's daylight, they call an emergency session and have this perfunctory vote to condemn Christ. And then they lead him off to Pilate. So go over to John 18, verse 28. And it says that they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. That's Pilate's hall. Basically, this is not only where Pilate lives, but it's also where he would have held court. And it was early in the morning, but they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Which, the irony there is shocking. Because here they have the Passover lamb, their Messiah, who they have scorned and now they have beaten and abused, who they have convicted illegally on so many accounts. They have shown an utter disregard to their own laws. They have shown an utter disregard, not just to their traditions, but to the law of Moses. They haven't cared. All they have worried about was in pronouncing him guilty and giving it some appearance of it being legal. And in every respect, they have acted wickedly. But they're not going to step foot into a Gentile household because they think that by doing so, they will now be ceremonially unclean and unable to take part in the Passover. It's a tragic irony. And I think John is making that point here very clearly, showing the absolute foolishness and the blindness, the spiritual blindness of this Sanhedrin, and being so much more concerned about their own traditions and keeping their ceremonial purity than they are with righteousness, justice, mercy, or truth. And so it goes on, verse 29. So Pilate went out to meet them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And I love their response. This is another one of the brilliant repartees here. They answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." What's he charged of? Well, if he wasn't a bad guy, we wouldn't have him here. They bring somebody into court and saying, what's the charge? Well, we wouldn't have arrested him if he wasn't a bad guy. He's arrested, therefore he's a bad guy. So just pronounce him guilty. That's what they're saying. And so Pilate's response is fine. Take him and judge him according to your own law then. You've pronounced him guilty. You take him and judge him according to your own law. You don't want to tell me what the charge is. You deal with it. It's too early in the morning for this kind of nonsense. And so then they say, verse 31, therefore the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die." Legally, they can't execute Jesus. And they're desiring still an appearance of legality in all of this. And they also say right up front, "We've condemned him as guilty. He deserves to die. You need to put him to death." They're not taking him to Pilate for a fair and impartial trial. They're taking him to Pilate so Pilate will rubber stamp their decision and execute Jesus.